Hi, Sophie. Thanks for being here with us. It's so great to be able to talk to you again.
Hi, Dave. Yeah, long time no see. So nice to be here.
Right. Could you give us an idea of what your role was in the production of Life on Our Planet?
So I was the producer and director of the episode, and that basically means that you design the show from all the editorial stories. So you design what the narrative is across the entire episode, and then you choose all the stories that you want to help tell that main narrative. And then you coordinate with your team going to film those sequences, and if they're VFX, you go and shoot backplates. So you kind of oversee the whole process, really, right from conception through to completion.
Okay, I found it really interesting with Loop that you did have different producers for different episodes. Why did they do it like that? And wouldn't it, you know, run the risk of it feeling disconnected in a way that, you know, like you've got someone producing episode one, you got a different person producing episode two. How did you like work it all into a single series scale narrative as well?
Yeah, so it's quite usual in dramas that something like The Mandalorian or pretty much any big series has different directors and producers for different episodes. So it's kind of standard in that world, and it is standard in our world because it's just too much work for one person to do eight shows. I mean, you'd have a breakdown. You'd have to be superhuman, I think, to achieve that. So series cohesion is really important. And right at the start of the series, we worked heavily with, well, yourself and other paleontologists. Tom Fletcher came on board a bit later. And there were some people before that, I think. So that was really important to set a foundation of what's the biggest story to tell here? How do we go about telling the story of evolution of life on Earth? And the science and I guess the science and the producers themselves bringing the kind of TV head to it. So it's like you want to represent and find this story that accurately tells the story of evolution of life on Earth. But at the same time, you need to make it visually engaging for an audience to sit through. Because if it's not entertaining, then, you know, people are going to give up and not watch anyway. So I guess it's that balance. It's sort of having the science nerds helping us shape it at the beginning and then kind of using the expertise from the television industry to kind of bring it together in a way that is really entertaining for the audience.
Yeah. So that's a really important point, and it's where I wanted to start this interview. So with this episode three, there are a lot of things that happen in this that are significant to the story of life on Earth. And yeah, I think that this episode tackles, you know, it tackles terrestrialization of plants, of invertebrates, of vertebrates. We've got amphibians and reptiles and synapsids, the differences between all of those major groups of vertebrates. And then we've got to kill the whole lot of them in this great dying, the Permo-Triassic mass extinction. So that represents, you know, like hundreds of millions of years of time. And during that time, there were so many different, like hugely fundamental, foundational, seismic, biological, and geological events that occurred. So why is it that you chose the ones that you did? And why is it that you didn't choose the ones that you missed? And, you know, like, how long could this episode have been?
Yes, gosh. I mean, it's a huge period of time. I think my show, episode three, spans roughly 250 million years, which is more than any other show. So it was a lot of time to get your head around. And of course, during that immense passage of times, like you say, such incredible things happened on land. And, you know, we couldn't tell them all. And yet we had to get a story that worked. And so it was a real challenge kind of reading as much as possible. I mean, that's how I usually start, is I like to just immerse into that time period, get my head around it, understand what was happening, what was the state of the continents, what was the state of the climate, what were the major events that happened during that time, what was happening in terms of evolution, which branches were taking off, who was the first to colonize land, then what happened, in what order did that happen? So you've got to get your head around all of that. And again, constant questions and back and forth between yourself and Tom of, you know, have I got this right? Did this evolve first? What was the first thing on land? Was it lichen? Was it plants? Did it come at the same time? And there's never a simple answer. That's the other thing, as you realize how complex life is. And so you're trying to weave a path through that makes sense in your own mind. And broadly speaking, I kind of, it made sense to me that there were these sort of radiations from the seas in terms of a sort of rough order. And that was lichen and microplants and small plants first, sort of non-vascular into vascular plants. And then invertebrates were sort of at the same similar time, slightly after some of the beginnings of, you'll correct me here, some of the beginnings of the sort of lichen and plants coming out to land, onto land, and then the sort of invertebrates. But roughly speaking, you could say that, you know, lichen and some of the non-vascular plants were first, and then invertebrates were next, and then it took vertebrates longer because their body plans were more complex. So they were a little bit slower. And to get that across to the audience, you had to kind of simplify into those three radiations, really. So that is what gave me the backbone of the narrative of the film. And then also in this time period, you sort of have the beginnings of the reptile and mammal lineage. Now, this is obviously way before reptiles and mammals are actually reptiles and mammals. So it's sort of the ancestors, if you like. It's those initial kind of division of the lineages was happening. And I thought that was a really important sort of marker, I guess, in evolution to kind of represent as well, was this sort of origin story, if you like, of two quite big lineages that would go on to have amazing stories. And that was another theme in Loop is that across the series, you want to tell these, it's like Game of Thrones, you want to tell these stories of where did the amphibians come from? Where did the fish come from? Where did the reptiles come from? And so you're following these great family paths back in time to see what they were like when they existed right at the beginning of their sort of evolution and then following those lineages through to modern day. So it was hugely complex. I mean, I've never worked on something so academically challenging as this. And, you know, I did zoology at Bristol University. So, yeah, I do have a background in science, but this was just fascinating, like to delve into the depths of time and really learn and have you guys on board to sort of ask all these questions, and just the exponential learning curve that we all went on with this series was really remarkable.
What were the events or organisms that didn't make it into the episode that you would have liked to have included?
Gosh, yes. I was thinking about this. I think Dimetrodon, I mean, again, there are the popular ones we've all heard of, but Dimetrodon, am I saying that right?
Dimetrodon, Dimetrodon, potato, yeah. Potato.
Dimetrodon was one that I remember seeing paleo art of and thinking, God, that is a bizarre, it's sail fin type reptile, isn't it? It's carnivorous and sort of, yeah, I guess a sort of one of its, was it an apex predator of its time?
Yeah, it would have been.
Yeah, and that was a really interesting looking creature. And we just, you know, tetrapod evolution. So the evolution coming out of the water and evolving to become amniotes, really, the amniotic egg, and through tetrapod evolution, we had to just cover that so quickly, especially that part. And there are so many amazing tetrapod fossils and stories and creatures. And I think we only managed to do one. We could only do one VFX because I had to choose three VFX sequences, main sequences, and pepper those through the show and make sure there was an even spread of those sequences. So obviously chose to do Arthropleura because that was in the invertebrate sort of realm. I guess plants and lichen, we got away with shooting modern versions of those today because whilst they have changed since back then, they still sort of represent quite well what plants might have looked like a little bit. Whereas You know, there are no giant millipedes alive on the planet today. Mm. Arthropleura was one I wanted to choose. And then you can't not do fish coming out of the water onto land. I mean, that had to be done. And I remember Per Aalborg was really helpful with that sequence because I couldn't work out how to tell that story. And the story is that obviously a lobe-fin fish or a type of species of lobe-fin fish eventually evolved into a limbed creature that was on land. But that process of that it takes millions of years, obviously, to evolve limbs from fins. And so fish that are coming out of the water for the first time would still have had fins. And they would have been a bit rubbish on land because they're not yet evolved to be on land. And then you have these sort of intermediate stage ones that are kind of a bit rubbish in both. They're not quite a fish and they're not quite a tetrapod. So they're just sort of this halfway house. And I didn't want the sequence to just be a creature coming out of the water and that's it. There'd be no greater drama because I just felt that was a bit flat. And so it was actually Pear that said to me, I was like, look, I've got this problem. I want to show this amazing, you know, one of the most important points in evolutionary history. What do you suggest? And he was like, well, you could do the idea that, you know, the fish, because lobe-fin fish would have still been around at the same time that tetrapods had evolved. So you could do a fish, play it for the fact it's sort of, you know, the first one out onto land or one of the first ones out onto land. But actually the twist being that door had already closed and that the tetrapods, the amphibian type creatures by this point had already evolved and the two would have coexisted. And of course, if you're a fish coming out at that point, once you're a tetrapod amphibian that is accustomed to life on land, you're never going to be able to come out of the water because if you'd just be so rubbish compared to an amphibian, you'd always get eaten. And I just thought that was a brilliant way to tell it because it had a nice twist in it. It could be surprising. And then it gives you the chance to push the story forward and go, you know, from the fish coming out of the water straight into these sort of tetrapod amphibian world, of which we still have that niche is still being used by amphibians today. So I thought it was a really neat way of telling that story. And then, of course, I had to tell, you know, when stuff really got big on land, this sort of proto-reptile mammal period in evolution. And I knew I knew that the Permian extinction was going to be covered in this episode too. So it made sense to choose Permian creatures for that, which kind of limited me to, you know, the Gorgonopsid, Scutosaurus type characters. So in a way, it was a sort of easy decision to pick, you know, those characters, but at the expense of that vast cast of prehistoric creatures from this incredible time period that I just had to gloss over because I couldn't, you know, they didn't help my main narrative. And so, yeah, it was sad, but
As a paleontologist coming into this and maybe as the audience listening, you kind of look at this time and just see all of these animals, all of these different environments, all of these stories that you could include. And it feels like you've got unlimited choice to do whatever it is, to show whatever it is. But then working in the production, you kind of realize the constraints that you have in storytelling, in budgets, in driving a narrative. And so, yeah, that it really is not an easy choice to make. And it is a very considered choice that you do make, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
So yeah, one of the things that I really was liking about the start of this episode was the fact that you included lichen. You included what I guess most people might consider to be a relatively boring group of organisms. So your whole episode opens on that. Was it worrying or concerning in any way that it's like, okay, here's episode 3. We're looking at little fancy things.
It was definitely a very, it was definitely heavily on my mind. That's for sure. The fact that this show was going to be opening with visuals of empty landscapes and then lichen that I really wanted to shine a spotlight on. And sort of TV executive producer alarm bells in my head were going off, because, you know, no one wants the show to sort of, I don't know, be boring up front. And they kind of, yeah, how do you sell Lycan, especially on paper or trying to explain it to people until you show them it? So I knew that the visuals had to be really strong. Like, if this was ever going to not just hit the cutting room floor and I get told to just, no, take it out, and you need to start with fish or whatever it is. So I was like, well, how do we film Lycan like it's never been filmed before? How do we make people understand how incredibly remarkable Lycan is? Because it is, genuinely. Like, the geek in me was like, I never even knew that, firstly, it wasn't even a single species, that it was two species that sort of teamed up, if you like, to solve this problem of leaving the ocean and go on to land. And that in itself is an incredible fact. So I wanted to educate people about that and tell people about that. But also, the other amazing thing about Lycan is that it's so diverse, so colorful, so resilient, and everyone can see it. No matter where you are on the planet, you can go outside and see Lycan. So it's exceptionally relatable. And I just really like that about it. And so I just thought, it's really accessible, it's really relatable, and people have never given it a second thought. No one goes outside and sort of clocks Lycan unless you're a sort of botany nerd. So I wanted to kind of make it work, I guess. And photo stacking time-lapse techniques really help with this. And I had an amazing assistant producer, Jolien, who actually shot them in his bedroom in lockdown. We'd gone into the first lockdown.
Wow.
And Jolien took a stills camera home, and he went out on some walks and he found some Lycan and he set it up in his spare bedroom and shot some initial shots of some of them. Actually made it into the show. But that's when it really sold it to us that this was going to work and this was going to show us Lycan in a way that people hadn't seen it before. Because what the photo stacking does is, Lycan, otherwise you have a really shallow depth of field because they're so small. Whereas the photo stacking is a technique where you take loads of images and you move the camera every time you take a photo, and it increases that depth of field when you stack them all together. So it means that you have a much bigger depth of field in vision, which means that it feels much more like a forest that you're sort of flying through. And I wanted to make Lycan feel like a forest. It was a challenge, but I hope that people have a newfound love and respect for Lycan, because it was something that we painstakingly tried to film and stick up for in the show.
Well, self-plug, if anyone wants to hear more about Lycan or fungal symbioses, then we do have an episode on that, and I really do recommend that, because it just completely blew my mind, the types of organisms that have an association with fungi. Basically every plant on the planet. So give that a listen. But then I was just so happy that you did open with Lycan, because for me that is, you know, the most important story in this episode is the fact that plants and fungi all got up onto land and they made it. They made the rest of the series possible from that point. It's that important. So I was really happy to see that. And another thing I was happy to see was the amount of arthropods. So Arthroplura is absolutely beautiful. I'll put that up front. It's probably the best Arthroplura I've ever seen. But as an animal in and of itself, there's nothing like it today or at any other time in history. This is, you know, just a giant, I can't remember what the dimensions are. It's like a meter and a half millipede. So when you are then responsible for trying to bring that to life, you know, you have nothing to copy. So did that bring a load of unique challenges when deciding how to recreate its shape and then also its behavior?
Yeah, well, Arthropleura is secret favorite. That was a great challenge. I mean, I think with all the VFX decisions that you have to make, you know, there's always going to be creative license where we don't know things. So color, for example, patination, those sorts of things, and behavior. But there were good fossils of the individual segments and various parts of the head and and body. And so we were able to use those segments and look at them to design the individual segments that made up Arthropleura. So some of it is very accurate, and the fossils are really nice, actually. You can really see the shape and detail of those individual segments. Add to that, you do have good reference from today in terms of millipedes that are around now. And they're actually millipedes that look not too dissimilar from Arthropleura in terms of sort of segment shape. So we kind of pieced it together using the fossil record, the trackways that, of course, have been found in the UK recently, to give a sense of scale and how they moved, and the feet placement and things. And yeah, we really built it from that, sort of all the academic papers that have measured all the segments and the sort of angle of the legs to the body and the height off the floor and all those things and all those tiny little details. I think even under, I can't remember if we made it male or female now, but there is the difference between male and female is that I think the males have the little hooks where they pass. Does the spermatophore go through? I don't know if you know that, but I think we did put little hooks on the male, actually, under his carriage. It was a tiny detail that probably no one will even notice. But they're like,
yeah, I think it's like the seventh leg or something like that is modified into these little genitals, essentially.
That's it.
And yeah, it's, you've really got to notice, you know, just like this missing leg in one of them is crazy, the detail then that goes into it. And seeing the underside of Arthropleura, there's one scene where it walks towards the camera and you get a lovely view of all the plates on the underside of it. And those details for me are what really bring it out. There's no reason why you had to go to that much detail to show the underside. You could have just shot the whole thing from the top, couldn't you?
Yeah, but I love that. I love that about the, because we wanted to get across the point that Arthropleura can't see very well and is virtually blind. And the only way to really do that was to have him sort of bump into something and find, you know, feel his way over it. And I just love that moment where he sort of rears up over the log. I think ILM did a brilliant job of that. And it's funny enough, we had tractor millipedes. Tom got some pet ones into the office. So we actually had live millipedes in the office for reference. So that, and we would put little pencils on the desk and let them and let them find the pencil, knock into them, and then kind of climb over them. And that's what we'd video that in the office. And they were mating in the office as well. So we were able to
The
physics of that and like how they wrapped around each other. And again, we sent all those videos off to ILM for animation reference. So yeah, the level of detail we went into for Arthropleura was quite quite painstaking. But I think I think we've created a really beautiful creature. I was really pleased with the way that worked out.
Yeah, I'm gonna have a word with Tom at the end of this episode just to ask him about all the pets that he has and what role they played in this documentary. Because he has got a zoo in his house.
It's just an excuse, isn't it? You can get more pets.
You mentioned then Arthropleura and the fact that it's got terrible eyesight. It tastes its environment with its antennae, and that's how it ends up finding its mate. It was a really enjoyable scene, and one of my favorite in the whole series. And as you say, it really drives home that it can't see very well. It was really fun to watch. And when you're watching natural history things, I always go in with a sense that it's going to be, you know, like pretty dry. It's just going to be factual. It's just going to be filming. And the fact that you used humor in this scene, and in fact other scenes as well, so you've also got the jumping spiders that relied a lot on humor as well. You've got the frogs trying to catch dragonflies. I don't know if you aimed for that to be funny, but I did find it funny, the timing and just how far gone that dragonfly was before the frog tries to shove it into its mouth in anticipation that it's made a successful predation attempt. I really enjoyed the humor throughout this episode. So I just wanted to know, is that kind of emotion a tool that you use in your storytelling? Why did you use humor as opposed to any other emotions that we might see more often in documentaries?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I think as a filmmaker, I always try to get emotional tone or emotional stories into the films because I just think it connects the audience better with what's going on. And I think if the audience are emotionally invested in a character or a scene or a story, then they're going to want to watch more and they're going to find it entertaining and they're going to learn more that way. You know, I think there's a big thing about humor, isn't there, and retention of facts. Like if you're delivering a lecture or something and you can make it funny, there's a sort of ratio that if you can make people laugh and then deliver a fact, they remember that fact more than if you hadn't made them laugh and it was very dry and they just had to sit through it. So there's definite science behind, you know, especially humor and the retention of information.
That's why I use that lichen pun.
Oh, you're one step ahead. Yeah, so I guess it's hard, isn't it? Because, you know, humor is a human construct, isn't it? I mean, I'm sure the spiders don't find themselves funny, nor do the millipedes, nor do the frogs. You know, they're just doing what they're doing. But us as observers do. And you know, we are making television for humans. You know, we're not making it for the spiders. So I think we are naturally putting a human perspective on everything we do, from kind of how we film things through to how we edit things through to what stories we tell. We're telling them for the benefit of other humans. And so I think, you know, if you can, without forcing it, I think it's really important not to put emotion in that doesn't belong or doesn't exist or is false jeopardy or any of those things. Like I try to avoid that in my films, like anything that is hamming something up for the sake of it, but actually it's a bit of a letdown when you watch the final behavioral moment because it doesn't actually really have much genuine jeopardy to it anyway. But if there is natural humor there, which they're definitely, you know, jumping dancing spiders, the frogs are hilarious unbeknown to them, then yeah, I think you play it for its strengths.
Yeah, and I was skirting around this question, trying to do it subtly, but I'm just going to go and bulldoze straight in. So one of the things that I have always disliked in documentaries, and this may just be me, is the anthropomorphization. Is that the right word? Anyway, is making them have essentially human emotion. And as you pointed out, the scene with the spider, that is not a funny scene to the spider. There is no humor in there. There is often, I feel, a generated emotional threat or something like that in those stories. And I've always felt uncomfortable with those, as if we are making the scene more than what it actually is in nature. So yeah, I was just trying to get to that. How do you avoid that? Do you try and play on that more than, or does the industry play on that more than it should?
You know, I think it's personal taste, and I think everyone is different in what they will and won't tolerate with anthropomorphizing creatures. As I say, like, it's, you know, we're making it for other humans. And I would rather make a film that is watched by a lot of people and enjoyed by a lot of people than make something that's so sort of biologically correct and in a way autistic.
Yep.
You know, and then no one watches it and no one, you know, it's not seen by anyone, so you're not getting the more important messages that you can. The power of film is so great. And if you can get impactful messaging across, why wouldn't you do it? And so if emotion can help do that, for me, that's a big win. But there's a spectrum. Every individual is different in what they will accept and what they won't accept in terms of where the balance lies. And I guess for me, the balance for me lies in hamming something up more than it should be because the footage just doesn't back it up, or anthropomorphizing so much that you're sort of saying that an animal is doing something because they feel something, or they feel a certain way, or emote a certain way. And, you know, I would never overstep the mark into assuming what a creature can and can't think, because, you know, we just don't know.
Yeah.
And so those there are lines that you can cross in that respect for sure. But it's interesting. It's a very interesting question. But I also think, you know, biology went through this, didn't it, in terms of its, I guess, how scientists related to animals. Like, I think, you know, we've gone through science, biology as a field of science has massively changed, where before, I remember when I sort of started my degree, there wasn't much in the way of kind of personality. They were studying personality in animals and theory of mind and all those things. But that was a relatively new thing. Like, you know, before it was just assumed that animals didn't have emotions and thoughts and feelings and personality types. And I just think that is fun. I mean, anyone that's owned a dog or a cat, you know, knows that's absolutely not the case. You know, animals are very astute. Just because they can't talk doesn't mean, you know, that they're not very aware, conscious beings that are capable of feeling things. So I don't know. I think it's a case by case basis, and it comes down to individual taste at the end of the day, where you draw the line. And yes, I do think some people get it wrong and push it too far. And then, but equally, I think when it's too dry, it's not engaging. And so then what's the point in making it if people aren't going to watch it?
Exactly. And I've been through the process of, you know, consulting for documentaries, I've been on quite the journey through this. I've gone from that very, it should just be science, 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 to understanding that yes, documentaries are made for people, and it's the people that we need to engage with. It's the people that we need to get on board, to listen to the messages, to watch it, to be entertained, to stick with it, and to understand what it is that we're showing and how and why. So yeah, I've been on a huge journey with that and changing my perspectives about documentaries. So it's, I think these insights are really important to get, these conversations like we're having now, where we unpack why you've shown something as opposed to something else and all of that. I think it's really important for people to understand how considered the contents of a documentary is.
Oh, every tiny frame is considered, that's for sure. Like, it's, yeah, I don't know if you found that, maybe kind of coming into the world of television, especially from a scientific background, and you realize just how crafted these documentaries are. I mean, they really are these big series, you know, every single frame, the edit cuts, the music, the words, everything is poured over time and time again. I mean, I must have seen my films by the time it came to final delivery, thousands of times. I must have watched the films and the cuts and the individual show. I mean, I could still, you know, when it puts it on, I verbatim know the script. I verbatim know the cut changes. Like, it's just ingrained in you. By the end of it, you have literally, the producer has seen it countless times, and you're thinking, it's all you sort of live and breathe it. So yeah, I would say that they are, everything is done with a purposeful mind.
Do you start talking in Morgan Freeman's voice in your head?
I'd love to. It'd be nicer than hearing my voice.
All right. Well, we will hear back from you in episode 8 later on, but thank you very much for talking us through episode 3.
Oh, thanks for having me.